Mark, Jake, and Mike, over to you.
Okay, thanks, Dan. Sorry if I didn't get a chance to go back and listen to Jim Bell's presentation. I don't know, Mike Wright, did you happen to go back and listen to Jim's from last week?
I did. It was very interesting.
Okay, so I would have, ideally, I would have liked to have made some better tie-ins there, so apologies if we're missing some kind of key linkages. You know, we could maybe follow up with something like that at a later time. Also, I wanted to just mention that at 3:30, we have Rick Sternbach from Star Trek fame here at Goddard. I don't know if you knew that or not, but we're having some Star Trek stuff going on here at Goddard, and I was going to beg for the chance to get out a little bit early to go listen to him, but I won't do that. We'll stick with the original time, Dan. And but if by chance we do finish a little bit early, that would free us up to go sit in on that. But it's not critical, obviously, that we do that. Just a bad timing, unfortunately. So this effort that we're going to try to summarize, we do kind of have a lot. I'm going to move quickly through some intro, and then I'll come back for maybe some preliminary implications if we have time. Some of those preliminary implications will come out. We can actually go to the next slide because I think we've got overview. The next slide, you just see a bunch of names from folks that we've kind of tapped into. This has been over the course of a few years, really, sort of on and off with a very small number of people working on this, with Mike Wright doing a lot of heavy lifting with detailed timeline development and talking with a lot of folks. Many of them are shown here. So I'll give a little bit of an overview and then come back for some preliminary implications at the end if we have time. Many of those implications will come out in the conversation as we go through some of these mission and task details. These are just highly notional analysis work that's gone on within the context of the Evolvable Mars campaign. It in no way represents any kind of commitment from the agency, obviously. Just things that folks are interested in exploring in terms of just understanding the possibility space. So it obviously then helps decision makers down the road figure out lots of things like what to do about architecture, campaign pacing, and what kind of technology investments to make, all that kind of stuff. So on the next slide, I will not go through this in great detail, but I did want to just hit on this process very quickly. This is sort of what we aspire to, a fairly robust process, fairly comprehensive process. We didn't necessarily execute all of this fully to date, but we've got lots of pieces of it. So in the top left-hand corner, just really tried to start out with getting a preliminary list of activities that we thought would have potential value, using a lot of intuition, talking to people, reviewing literature. Oh, by the way, obviously lots of people have been working on this in the past, including Dan Lester and Harley Thronson and many others. There's a good body of literature on this, and it has informed a lot of what we've done. In fact, we've seen ourselves as sort of taking a bunch of next steps to try to understand what it might mean for an architecture, for a campaign, for technology development, for ops cons. So we started out by sort of thinking about what some of these tasks might be based on a lot of past work that's already been done. Then trying to think about where the favorable benefits might be, the favorable risk benefits might be, to winnow that list down a little bit further. Then try to get into some timelines and actually see what some details might look like, how much time things might take at a sort of micro level as well as in the aggregate, maybe the latter being more interesting in many cases. Then try to get through some preliminary implications, develop and use models to inform further analysis and testing, conduct some sims, field tests. That kind of stuff has been going on, and we've been sort of learning from that a little bit and feeding into that a little bit. That's what all these arrows and lines are trying to show, that we really want to feed back into what other people are doing. And then prioritize these driving tasks a little bit more, narrow it down a little bit more, and drill down a little bit more. We think we're getting there, but probably not really completely there. We envision that stakeholders, and this is part of this presentation, actually, that people would start to weigh in a little bit more detail on how they see low-latency teleops. And then all of this, sort of feeds back into the EMC task teams and the integration team over here on the left-hand side. And I know you guys can't see my arrow floating around there. Okay, so then the next slide, slide five, this was just a first start at thinking about the very big picture. What are all the contexts? What are all the domains? So there's kind of an in-space domain, just sort of, you know, free-flying type assets. Then there's lunar orbit to surface, lunar surface to surface, which we did not really get into. In part, that's not part of what we're supposed to be looking at. Then asteroid, Mars moons, and then Mars orbit, Phobos to Mars surface, then surface to surface, and dormancy ops. There are others to be added to this list, of course, but this is kind of a casting the net kind of widely to see where, to see what the big picture really looked like and how some of these things might interrelate. And we have really not focused heavily on all of these, really only just a few to date.
Can you explain dormancy ops a little bit better?
Yeah, that's kind of the idea that an asset may be in space in cislunar, like a HAB facility, for example, and it may have assets on it that can be operated without crew on board, but maybe, say, from Earth, for example.
Oh, so during the quiescent zone is another way to phrase it, or uninhabited zone.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's a reasonable way to put it.
Okay.
Yeah. In fact, interestingly, the architecture team actually had a team devoted. In principle, it still exists. We're wrapping a lot of things up right now, but dormancy ops is actually a whole task unto itself because people recognize that a lot could go on without necessarily having crew on board. Okay, so for slide six, then.
Hey, Mark, before we move on, this is Terry Fong. Just a question about the 0.5 second cutoff there. Was that driven by considerations of manual control loop stability or time to criticality for certain activities? Could you just talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. And as you noted, if we go back to that slide, I said that, you know, the effective LLC response times vary per task, goal, objectives, expectations. I almost didn't even want to put this on here, Terry, because I know people have different ideas about what LLC really means. Maybe what's most important, I guess, for this presentation is just the idea that, and we're working on a paper right now where I put this into different words, that we're trying to just target times that, yes, there would be the ability for a human to respond quite quickly. So in some past literature, there have been references to this time frame as just a very rough sort of guidepost for how a time within which people can respond reasonably well to things. Now, not necessarily for haptics or force feedback, but maybe to some extent some visual data or other kinds of information. But that number, in fact, one of the things we want to do more of and why we try to look at a lot of tasks to just get into some of the details, however conceptual it's been so far, and why some people are doing lots of tests in the field, and you Terry, are one of these people that have done some of these tests, is to try to understand how that number may vary. What is the effective actual latency as a function of task and really ultimately what you expect to get out of any given task, right? High levels of latency may be perfectly fine for lots of things depending on what the very specific need is at the moment. So that may not be a perfect answer to your question, but it was just a way of providing a little rough guidepost that can relate to distances in space, but it is admittedly imprecise. Okay, so the next slide just shows one way of framing some driving questions. So these are kind of categorized into general and more specific. So generally, what activities may be preferable to conduct prior to crew landing? What's the risk reduction value of each of those activities? What is any other value there might be? What is the likelihood of completing those activities when desired, for example, prior to landing the crew? And remember, this is more in the context of the EMC. So the question of pre-crew, post-crew landing is arguably meaningful. Which tasks should be prepared to conduct via LLT as primary operations mode versus a backup mode? Which tasks are likely to have greatest architectural campaign and system impacts? Then a little bit more specifically, how important is it to do in situ site assessments before landing the crew? Same thing with preparing the surface. Is that important to do in any way before landing the crew? Prepare or integrate assets on the surface before landing the crew? Then what about surface science? What would we like to do before landing the crew there? And then maintenance tasks, should we be prepared to conduct those by LLT prior to crew landing? So you see, a lot of this has a lot to do with prior to crew landing. It's the way we chose to frame some of this initially to help drive out certain kinds of functionality and other kinds of driving considerations. So next slide. We tried to, this is just one small snapshot of a whole bunch of objectives and activities we tried to put together a number of years ago when we had a cislunar task. So this work is representative of about three different tasks. One of them was a cislunar LLT task a number of years ago, which we co-worked with a crew assistant sample return task, which you'll see in a second. There's some overlap there in terms of LLT, so we kind of put those two tasks together. Anyway, we tried to put together a whole bunch of goals and activities, and then we traced those goals and activities to a broader NASA goals and activities document that we've been working off of for a number of years. So these are just some examples. These are sort of more in the general category. Obviously, we want to try to figure out where and how to test basic LLT operation. Now, we're thinking mostly beyond station here. This is in cislunar because we know folks like Terry and others have done good work on showing how we can test with station, and I imagine that's going to continue. We want to test the comm and data infrastructure to whatever extent we possibly can, including interfaces, test and demonstrate a lot of maintenance and repair of assets if folks think that that's important to be prepared for. We thought it was reasonable to capture it as a potential goal. Demonstrate ops coordination between EVA crew, IVA LLT, and ground control. That whole dance, you know, operationally, how is that choreographed exactly, and what can we learn about it, the totality of activities that will involve lots of people in different locations, and then demonstrate in parallel high latency tele robotics for public outreach. You know, maybe there's something to be mined there. Maybe there's some real value in trying to figure out if and how the public might get more involved in this kind of thing. So again, we developed a lot of these, and then did a very basic tracing to a larger document. So the next slide. Cislunar concepts and tasks. So here.
Hey, Mark, this is Dan Lester. I'm going to play moderator here and ask you again to please quote slide numbers. The words next slide. All right. You just keep saying that, and that's just going to get everybody mixed up. I don't really know where you are right now.
Okay. My mistake. Slide 8. This is just the title slide for the next section. So in the cislunar task that we had, we did looked at quite a lot of tasks. We'll just show just kind of a few. And one related task was that we looked at and analyzed was crew assisted sample return. We were emphasizing more the role of a habitat in looking at that. That concept has been looked at by others, JPL and Lockheed, and some papers have been written, Jack Burns and others. And so we had a task to try to extend some of that thinking a little bit, revisit it maybe a little bit, and think about the role of a habitat. So on the next slide, number 9, this is just a kind of very high-level ops con that I thought I would show to sort of illustrate this, and then just quickly note that sort of the two orange texts. On the left-hand side, we see the opportunity to use LLT to operate a rover, look for a sample on the moon. In this case, we assumed something like a 60-day mission in total, and so we wanted to figure out, like, how much time would there be perhaps to look for a sample, interleave it with other activities. That integrated timeline is not in this slide deck, but we try to look at things in totality to see what it really meant. What could you really do, however theoretical, in a certain amount of time? So anyway, this is meant to show there's LLT to try to find some samples, bring them back to orbit, and then I wanted to put this in here, too, because a question that I have for folks in the community more broadly is, when this sample is brought to space or is already in space brought by somebody else, does LLT have a role for actually assessing the containment of that sample, mitigating any breaches of containment, possibly cleaning the outside of the sample, that kind of thing, just making sure that sample containment has the kind of integrity you really would want it to have before returning to Earth. Now, in the case of the moon, the planetary protection requirements are not really something people are particularly worried about. But for a Mars sample, for which this whole scenario could feed forward into, it might be important, more important, to have some ability to make an assessment of that sample containment unit at some distance, and maybe LLT, a series of LLT assets in space could help you do that. So I've eaten up my 10 minutes and wanted to go to slide number 10. And Mike Wright will jump in here and start to go through some other types of tasks, the maintenance tasks in Cislunar that we had started to contemplate.
Sure. Thanks, Mark. This slide 10 just basically summarizes, I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but it summarizes some of the range of tasks that we considered possibly being implemented via low latency telerobotics, and identifying those that would be prime candidates for LLT. Those highlighted in bold are ones we felt in this particular phase, and this was very early on. We were looking at in-space maintenance, lunar surface maintenance, that kind of thing. And that included things like power system, battery replacement, sample collection, as Mark had mentioned, and fission power system servicing, which in that particular instance where you want to minimize crew proximity to radiation sources, LLT would particularly lend itself well for that kind of thing, with, as you see, crew as a backup in case, you know, that was necessary. We also looked at solar electric propulsion, maintenance and repair, including things like xenon refill, that sort of thing. And in the case of instruments at the bottom, felt that, you know, that was critical enough where you may very well want a lower latency operation, if not a crew involvement, for some of the more critical components involved in a scientific instrument. Some of these other ones are certainly LLT possible, but then they're also possible via medium and high latency as well. And in some, as you see on the left column there, also via autonomy as well. So go to slide 11. This is just a representative timeline that we developed for the SEP refueling. And the reason this is a good representation is it shows the variety of tasks and the level of detail that was afforded to this assessment, looking at the specifics associated with the refill operation, the hardware manipulation, and that sort of thing, and involving, in this particular case, two vehicles, one, you know, the receiver, and the other, the servicing vehicle, and then a teleoperated prop transfer system. So this was one of those timelines that was particularly complex. And again, this was early on in some of the work that we did starting a couple of years ago. Slide 12 just introduces this next concept of the Phobos base mission concept, whereby you've got a crew operating, exploring.
Slide 13, sorry to interrupt, Mike.
I'm sorry, yes, 13, going to the next one. You've got a crew operating the telerobotic assets that are on the surface or in orbit as needed, but basically on a 500-day mission that would presumably be available to set up assets on the surface prior to crew landing on the planet surface from Mars orbit. Now, we took a look at this in more detail, and you go to the next slide, 14. Summarize.
Although Mike, sorry to interrupt. I did want to mention that there is a EMC task that's devoted to basically looking at a human Phobos mission.
Right.
So a lot of what Mike is going to go into now was kind of done within the auspices of that specific team.
Right. And that team is led by Mike Gernhardt out of JSC. We've got several folks supporting that, and this was just one small aspect of that activity. So on slide 14, you see the summary of some of the tasks that we took a look at to delve deeper into the LLT operations for things like site reconnaissance assessment, looking at, you know, once you've determined where you're potentially going to land crew, you know, what are the potential hazards, what resources do you have there, for example, for ISERU plants, for science exploration. And the second category was surface prep, whereby you've got an excavation system. You want to level it out for landing, for hab placement, that kind of thing. And then third was outpost setup and integration, where you've got landers now on the surface that you can offload telerobotically. Power system deployment, again, where you've got fission power systems requiring placement and integration, providing keep-alive power for the landers, setting those up, in some cases, 1 kilometers from the landing site, ISRU plant setup, and HAB deployment and integration. The next category we looked at was outpost operations, where now you've got everything configured and integrated. Now you're in full-up operations where you can do ISRU resource utilization, science recon, sampling and analysis, and you're into repair and maintenance operations at that point, and traversing for resources as well as science. And then the last category, science operations, particularly that involving special regions, involving, you know, where planetary protection is important, and science lab operations. And then future work, we've got things like sample capture, as Mark mentioned, proximity operations, and potentially work, you know, on telemedicine, which would be particularly important for long duration space flight, of course. Okay, slide 15.
Question.
Yes.
Past studies have shown that back and forth to the moon is well within people's ability to compensate for the lag that exists. So how did you compare or contrast or rationalize the need to do these things from lunar orbit or L1 versus the Earth's surface?
The length of time versus you mean the latency, basically. Why latency? Well, if you go back to slide 10, you can see that some of these tasks do lend themselves to that sort of thing, and some don't. The reason we feel that they don't is because of the critical nature, for example, the critical nature of the instruments or the assets on the surface, i.e., if you've got something important that costs you $2 billion to construct and you've only got one of them, do you really want to, find out 2 hours later that something failed, you know, that it didn't quite get situated properly or handled properly? Number two, you want to have a capability of, say, an abort, immediate abort capability, whereby if there's something goes wrong, let's say you're offloading a lander and you've got hardware that's close to each other, you really want to be able to, say, abort a lift if things aren't quite working out the way you expect them to work out. Earth to Mars wouldn't work for that, and
We're talking Earth to Moon.
I'm sorry, Mars Moon surface to Mars surface.
We might quickly note that, and we'll get into this maybe a little bit later. It is an interesting question, just in general, what was just asked. And one very broad answer is, to the extent that doing high fidelity tests in cislunar space to prepare for what you might do in the Mars environment,
right,
that might be worth doing. That's a pretty high level question, but that's a lot of what was motivating some of this early on, was to just sort of say, yeah, what is worth doing as practice and
right.
test in cislunar to be prepared for at Mars?
This is Dan Lester. Let me give a very short and clear answer to that. And that is, I think as it was just answered, it really depends on the task. And I'll give you an example. The highest level of dexterity and that you can do usually requires haptics. And even if it doesn't require haptics, requires low latency. An excellent example of that is telerobotic surgery. Got a lot of studies about telerobotic surgery and what kind of latencies are possible. And doctors won't touch telerobotic surgery if the latencies are over half a second.
Yeah,
They simply won't go there.
Yeah, I don't want latent surgery.
I'm saying telerobotic surgery is an excellent example of the kind of task that requires high dexterity. That's what telerobotic surgery is.
Right, and you could analogize to some of the maintenance and repair requirements that are going to end up being, you know, coming up where you've got assets on the surface that need to be repaired, and some of them fine. You think back at some of the Hubble repair missions where you really did need some fine, dexterous, you know, and you've had crew there. So now in these particular situations, when you don't have crew, under our assumption for the purposes of this study, you would definitely need that low latency. So, well put, folks, on that. If we're ready, we can go to slide 15. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on this, but it does summarize some of the key assumptions for developing the timelines for the low latency operations. So we are assuming a Phobos base. Now, last week, there was some discussion about Deimos, but I do want to point out that while you do have a line of sight that is longer than Phobos in the case of Deimos, you also have a loss of signal that's longer as well. So, and it's lower gravity. But for the purposes of our Moons of Mars team, we've been talking about a Phobos base. And so for the purposes of this first, at least of this initial cut, we had to pick some, you know, place by which the operations would take place. And so Phobos was a reasonable assumption for this situation. Line of sight generally lasts about 4 hours, and there's a typo there, 4 hours, and then every the cycle is every 11 hours, more or less. So the loss of signal assumed for these timelines is about 7 hours. Now, all this said, keep in mind that eventually there probably will be a TDRS in Mars orbit that's going to help crew and other assets communicate. I mean, there's already going to be that capability there. So this was just going to be the worst case. What could we possibly do if we didn't have continuous coverage, comm coverage? And so this is kind of what we came up with. So unless otherwise noted on these timelines, the loss of signal is a no-op period. There are some things where you could do autonomously, and you'll see later in one of the example timelines, ISRU is a particularly good case where you've got a lot of autonomy associated with that. So you can take advantage of those loss of signal times. And also lengthy tasks, well, we talked about that, the autonomy there on that third to last bullet. And then the contingency wait time we added when necessary. For if you know ahead of time where you're going to have a line of sight, loss of signal imminent, well, you don't want to start up a critical operation. You want to kind of hang loose and then wait for that till you get comm back in order to start that operation. Let's see what else is notable here. Well, hey, the task durations are representative of stuff that's happened already. Servicing missions, RRM, some of the ISS ground telerobotics missions, such as those that Terry has been involved with. And in fact, that was very informative with regards to some of this overhead time that has been incorporated into this, and it turns out to be quite a chunk where you've got logs and power-ups and other things that have to happen where you're just kind of waiting. And I think oftentimes timelines are developed that tend to be very optimistic without regard to the overhead time associated with a lot of these tasks. So we wanted to be very conservative and realistic. So you'll see those a couple of examples later on. Slide 16 just shows you an example of one of those sequences where we were doing site reconnaissance and hazard assessment. Took a representative area. 1 kilometer represents the approximate landing zone where you've got a landing area in the middle and a 1 kilometer radius zone that might need to be assessed for any hazards, large boulders, that kind of thing. And so taking samples at various locations, that could be seismic type characterization, surface samples, and just basically, you know, what the terrain really looks like. I mean, presumably you've got some amount of elevation data, but this would be ground truthing, if you will. And in this case, we took to limit our time, because we don't have an infinite amount of time, we took samples 100 meters apart and did drilling and that kind of thing. So the next slide, 17, shows a representative timeline for a hazard assessment survey for one location. In this case, it lasts 30 hours, three shifts. We took one shift as being 12 hours, one crew shift. And then you can see where the loss of signal, the light blue areas are the periods where you don't have comm coverage. Anyway, that's just an example. Go ahead.
And Mike, if I could jump in and point out too that some folks may be kind of wondering, aren't we assuming that all of this is going to get done prior to humans even going into the Mars vicinity? And that's one big question in some sense. I mean, I think everyone's intent would be hopefully to do a lot of this recon ahead of time with a lot of traditional robotic missions. But in a stressing case where there was additional site, say, let's say validation, that was a word that folks within the EMC were more comfortable with, to the extent that additional site validation might be needed, we were just looking at the execution of that without necessarily judging its ultimate architecture or campaign value.
Right. That's a good point. And one other thing I wanted to bring up is a lot of these durations, some of them are where they're critical, whereby we really didn't have the expertise to estimate. We did get expert advice on some of these, like Honeybee Robotics, for example, had some Chris Agnew had some good input on some of these durations and capabilities of some of the tools that we were thinking about for these. The next slide, 18, is the ISRU timeline I was telling you about earlier. And that's a good example because it's multi-shift. It really takes advantage of your loss of comm there by using autonomous operations. But yet it also has some handshaking with regards to the LLT operations and some of the work that can be done via LLT to help assist in some of the ISRU resource utilization. Next slide, and I think this is my last one, slide 19. We're kind of like thinking, well, how are we going to basically assess each task as with a value toward LLT or the value-based assessment? And we kind of, and a lot of this was subjective, admittedly, but we did look at some tasks, and there's some examples there. Surface prep, we felt, was low to medium sensitivity to latency or a loss of signal, meaning if you had something that had to be done immediately preceding a loss of signal, then it might be critical. If there was a high risk of anomaly, misalignment on a ramp or lifting where you might not be, presumably you know where your CG is for all the equipment, but let's say you had a critical piece of hardware, say a fission power system that you really didn't want to, that you really wanted to be sure you had critical handling for, and in lifts and mates where you had very little tolerance for any long latency. So that's where these numbers come from. We did that for the science recon sampling analysis, considering that medium, some of it could be autonomous, drill handling, maybe not, depending on the type of drill. Obviously, we've seen some drilling on Mars already autonomously or with long latency. It can take quite some time to do that, as was indicated at last week's FISO. I think it was a case of where, you know, it could take, you know, several days to get something accomplished. But that's taking advantage of your high latency if you've got the capability. And core sample transport is considered medium-high sensitivity because even though traversing can be autonomous, but the handling of the critical samples is required. You don't want to, if you've got a critical sample that you've, the science sample that you want to make sure you handle properly, that is, for example, removing from one rover and placing it into a lab, you want to have some level of control over that. I think I used up my slides, so now we're going to carry on with Jake Bleacher.
Okay, so we'll move on. Slide 20, just the title slide, low latency telerobotic science. So, again, as Mark and Mike have discussed so far, science is one of the aspects that might have some impact on it from an architecture that includes low-latency telerobotics. So there's a handful of us that have worked in support of this task, these tasks over the last few years. And then we also reach out and work with scientists from the community to try and provide some feedback as Mike and Mark and others are progressing through these studies. Just a few points here. You know, as we look forward to exploration of the solar system, one way to think about the way NASA does this is that the Science Mission Directorate and Human Operations are two different groups, and maybe they're exploring completely individually without respect to each other. I think most of us would agree that that's not the way we would ideally envision exploration of the solar system as humans go on beyond low Earth orbit. So there's some kind of hybrid here in the middle where human exploration and science goals are going to be merged. And so our goal really is to try and figure out how can the architecture help us maximize the science return that we get back. So the architect, you know, one way to look at it from the humans doing science is the architecture could be very constraining and very limiting, or the architecture could be very enabling and really help us out as we try to achieve science goals out in space. So this slide here, slide 21 again, is just one way of kind of casting this trade space we're looking at. With Apollo up there in the upper right, we had boots on the ground. So the human dexterity on site was very high, but also the mission risk, human life and cost was also very high. The way we've been doing things since then is portrayed by the picture at the bottom left. An example would be Curiosity. So here, the risk, especially to human life, has significantly decreased, but we lose some of that dexterity that a human will give you. So we're really talking about this trade space in the middle. If we start having robotic assets and humans roughly in the same system, how can they work together? So low-latency telerobotics could be envisioned in a very beneficial way for science exploration, but how exactly do we envision that being applied? And that's what we're talking about now. So as we move on to slide 22, I'm pulling a couple slides here from other groups because I want to make sure that we're clearly representing the fact that it's not just two or three scientists sitting in a dark corner and every once in a while Mark reaches out and we tell him what we think. MEPAG recently had a special action group called the Human Science Objectives Group. And so we re-looked at the MEPAG goals at Mars and how those might be influenced by what we call a proximal human, so a human in the Mars system. And one of the tasks in the HSOSAG was to look at robotic and human interaction. And so we brought in a number of roboticists from JPL, some folks from Ames, JSC, to help us kind of think about this. And so there are a number of different ways to think about humans and robots. One way is through the style of interaction, and one way is through the type of control that you have. So you can envision, you know, humans and robots working together on the ground. You can envision them working together, but they're separated by some time. And then robots can work completely independently with crew nearby or with crew somewhere else entirely. You can envision crew operating robots directly on site. You could be in a rover or some other location on the surface. You could be back at Earth, or you could be on the moons of Mars. So, again, large groups of folks are starting to think about these problems, and we're trying to draw the knowledge that was gained from different areas and feed that into what these tasks have been studying. As we move on to slide 23, again, this is just to say where we are looking now is that low-latency telerobotics from the moons of Mars to the surface could be used to conduct science before humans get there. But another way to think about this, too, is they could be operating in places where humans can't go. You know, we want to really look at the full playing field here, and in many ways, having robots that humans are operating telerobotically, even if the humans are in the Mars system, could expand the areas that we get to operate in. So the goal for us as scientists was not really to try and define the low-latency architecture, but beginning to explore how low-latency influences science. And really what it comes down to is where do we invest funding to make sure that science is maximized as we're doing that. And then the last point there is a point I made in several other talks, is and Mark made this earlier, and Mike as well, that this probably will involve what's called the proving ground right now, that's cislunar space. So as we're making our way out to the Mars system, there could be opportunities to test some of these concepts in the cislunar space area, the proving ground. So moving on to slide 24, low latency science related work. This is just gives a brief background on some of the tasks or work that's been done over the last several years. Again, this is not all the Evolvable Mars campaign. So Dan's been involved in most all of this with us from the beginning, as well as Harley, and different folks have participated at different levels. But had an exploration telerobotics symposium in 2012 that generated a report to League, in which we brought in folks from industry and commercial sector who are using low-latency telerobotics now, exploring deep sea or exploring in mines or hazardous environments. A technical interchange meeting occurred between several of the centers. Terry Fong, I heard him speaking earlier, he actually ran a test from ISS deploying some hardware that you can see down there in the lower right there at Ames. So we were actually, in that effort, Terry was driving ISS operations, low-latency telerobotics operations here on the surface. I already mentioned the MEPAG Special Action Group on Human-Robot Collaboration. Right now, League has a special action team called the Human Exploration Proving Ground. So that's, again, we keep coming back to this, the Moon system as a proving ground for working our way to Mars. And then I'm sure Dan can let anybody that wants to know about the KISS Low Latency Telerobotics Workshop at JPL and Caltech that's coming up later this year. So we move on to the next slide, 25. As we came out of that meeting in 2012, which was wrapping some of the scientists into it, one of the key observations that a group of scientists, those of us involved, made pretty early on was that state-of-the-art NASA instruments work very well within the high-latency operational framework. So that's like the MER rovers, Opportunity and Spirit, vehicles like that. But they don't necessarily work well within a low-latency framework. So, if you get the question, how would you apply low latency? You know, some folks think that's about driving faster, having better dexterity. From a science standpoint, the question came up, well, if you can move faster, that would be, I guess, nice. It does save some time, but if the measurements still take 3 days to make, how much time do you actually save? And so this is where we started getting into the timeline work with Mike, is what is the impact on the timelines if you apply low latency, and where does science need to make investments to catch up? So the big question then was, how can we make sure instruments are developed and work well within a low latency paradigm? So we're evaluating the impact of low latency on timeline work. That's what we've been doing with Mike and Mark, and they started showing you some of that with other aspects like ISRU, and we did the same for science. This leverages heavily off of field studies that have been done going back to ESMD earlier, and then recently CERVI, which is Solar System Exploration Research Virtual Institute, is funding projects that integrate science and human spaceflight. So I work on a team called RISE, which is out of Stony Brook, New York. We do field studies focused specifically on testing currently available portable instrumentation and seeing how those timelines fit back into things like Desert Rats, which was when we tested the vehicles, like the space exploration vehicles, and conducted full-on EVA-style traverses through deserts in Arizona. We didn't use instruments during that, so we're trying to look back now and integrate those timelines with what does it take to actually use something like a portable XRF or a portable LIBS or XRD. Next slide, please. So slide 26 now. I'll go through the next several rather quickly. Again, this is coming off of Mike's efforts to talk to scientists and engineers around the community and start to build the baseline for building these timelines. So we didn't just make this up, a few of us. This is based on work that's already been done. So prior to the MEPAG HSOSAG, back in 2008, there was another study called the HEMSAG. That was Exploration of the Mars Science Analysis Group. And they actually developed some traverses, in this case, centered on the Centauri Montes region, which is on the Hellas Basin. And so Mike took that, you know, that's already been vetted by the science community. And so we started there, and we're looking at some of the science that was recommended that could be done at some of these sites. So again, the main point of this slide is just to point out that the underlying science is something that's been vetted for years, and we're looking at it from the perspective of what happens if we have low latency telerobotics applied to it.
So, and we did talk briefly with Jim Garvin, who kind of even though it's 2008 is a little bit of a while ago, but he did say that's still basically valid to go for scenarios like this that they've already developed.
True.
In case anyone is wondering about the date on that.
So now we're on slide 27, and this is just showing how we started to think about breaking down low-latency telerobotics from a science perspective. One of the things that popped up right away, almost all of us came up with right away, was that we probably need to divide the slower instruments from the faster operating instruments. So if you're going to take advantage of low latency applied to potentially driving or navigating, or operating, maybe sample handling, one of the things that you want to do is get the things that can operate quickly separated from the slower instruments so they can continue to move off in a different direction. So fairly quickly, we came to this point about separating instruments onto two different rovers. However, the interesting point from a science standpoint is if you ask 10 different scientists probably how they would divvy up the types of measurements, you'll probably get 10 different answers. So this type of a study is very helpful for us as well. It gives us some feedback about, well, you know, is instrument A better on the recon fast-moving rover, or is it better situated on the slower-moving rover? And so the science topic that we ended up focusing on was the search for whether or not life ever existed on Mars. So there's a number of different approaches that fit into that. Again, if you ask 10 different scientists, they probably are going to agree on the types of measurements we want to make. They might not agree on the specific instruments that would make those measurements, and again, maybe not on how you divvy them up among the rovers. But Mike went into pretty strong detail in trying to understand what's the best and quickest way we can make those measurements now, and that gives us a baseline to start thinking about where do we need to make improvements from a science instrument standpoint. Go ahead. So on to slide 28. Down at the bottom, Mike showed a number of these different types of timelines. These are the results when you start to stack up all of the different things that we'd like to do. And it's the same here. In this case, though, we show the different instruments. And again, Mike did an exhaustive job looking at, you know, what do instruments like this do now? What would be reasonable guesses about how they might work faster in the future? And so the point here is just to show that we really dug into the literature on that. Again, Mike did a really great job. And so one way to think about this is how many measurements, one question the engineers can ask the scientists, how many measurements do you want to make? How long will it take to do that? The way the scientists maybe think about this is how long or how far could we go if we want to make the following measurements? It's just a slightly different way that we think about it. From a science perspective, as you explore an area, we don't really think about a cadence of every few meters we make a set of measurements. We think about trying to prioritize when and how often do we want to make the measurements based on the science and the geology that's there. So it's just two different ways to think about it, but this kind of a timeline study really gives us better equips us to start making decisions about, okay, we know within the timeline we have, we can maybe make 20 measurements. Do we really want to make one right now, or do we want to keep moving on and get farther along and cover more space? Go on to slide 29. And this is just another example of driving those timelines forward. And this is the sampling rover, whereas on the previous slide was the recon rover. Next slide, slide 30. So as we went through that process, then the big question that Mark and Mike threw at us was, okay, so if you have four crew members and they're on the moons of Mars and they have this slow-moving rover and a faster-moving rover and they're operating in a low-latency environment, how do we actually dedicate crew time to this? Or another way to ask it is, how much crew time is being used up. Because as we all know from ISS, crew are also doing other tasks. So that's the big question here is when you start to stack up all these things that are going on, how much time do you actually have left for science? Within that time, how much can you actually get done? So how much science work could be completed? So we started looking into this. If you have two rovers, a recon and a sampling rover, so we suggest that during active science operations, we would basically want a science lead. So from all of the analog tests we did with desert rats, and Nemo's been doing this too recently, we talk about an IV scientist or an IV crew member. They're kind of like the quarterback of the science that's going on. They're sitting in the habitat or they're sitting in the rover, and they're directing what's going on. Because if you have a long comm delay back to Houston, that takes them out of the loop. So you need somebody on site in that low latency environment that's calling the shots. So in this case, during science operations, we would have probably one crew member at least that's a science lead that's dedicating all of their time to what's going on, again, during science operations. The recon rover, which is we assume drives a little bit faster and has the faster moving instruments on it, this would be a second crew member's time that would be dedicated to this, but they might perhaps only need to spend 50 to 60% of that total amount of time operating that rover. Again, the science lead who's spending 100% of their time is the one that's really thinking about the results, making decisions. That second crew member is driving that rover, but that does start to free up some of their time to do other tasks like maintenance and keeping the habitat operable. Now, the second rover would require a third crew member's time. It would be the sampling rover, the slower moving rover. This would have more tasks that are automated and probably would require a little bit less of that third crew member's time, maybe in the ballpark of 20 to 30%. Again, these are some guesses, best guesses that we can make about this. But the point here is to understand that the way we envision it, there would really only be three of the four crew members operating during science ops, and not all three of them would be spending all of their time on those tasks. So we start to get a ballpark guess here about how we can fit science into the operations that are going on.
And that in turn feeds into if we have a 500-day mission we're looking at Phobos. Ultimately, we might be able to say something rough about what could you complete in the totality of that whole mission. And that's sort of the bigger picture that why we focused a lot on timelines was to just try to see if we could get a rough idea ultimately of things in the aggregate. What would it mean for, say, a short duration mission or a longer one of 500 days? And we do have a little bit more work on that maybe it's not quite as mature as we'd like it to be to show here, but that's kind of the bigger picture architectural direction that we're heading in.
And so the last bullet there on slide 30 is how do changed assumptions alter the overall timeline? And that's kind of where we are now, and this is where we're doing a lot of our field work. Again, we've been doing this for about a decade, thinking about how these portable instruments really enable us to do science. Which ones do we need? What are the measurements we need? Now there are a bunch of different groups that are starting to study the same thing. But the real question comes down to, out of all these different studies, for science perspective, is where do we need to put that tech development? What is good enough? What is a good enough measurement on that recon rover to be able to direct the sampling rover? So, you know, this is a little bit different than the way NASA traditionally builds instruments. We like to be as precise as possible, as accurate as possible. In a recon setting, in a low latency setting, you might not need to be that precise. You might want to get more measurements. So, this is the interesting part for us, and it's really directing a lot of the field work we're doing now. So we move on to slide 31. It's kind of just pulling this all together, evaluating low latency timelines. Sets the stage for us to start asking the important questions now about how do we develop most effective low-latency tech and operations to achieve science. Which are the measurement types that we really need to have, and which of those fit well within a low-latency paradigm? How do we best use this dual or maybe multiple rover scenario? We might even have more than two rovers, depending on how this pans out. And then how do we best divide that telepresence workload between humans in the Mars system and humans back at Earth, because we know we can do high latency robotic operations on Mars. Some of the tasks that we want to do from a science perspective might remain better done from Earth. And how do we separate those tasks and offload to the low latency rovers and low latency capabilities?
Slide 32. And we're done. So, and we thought we might not get to this last section, and that's okay because a lot of the implications came out in the conversation, but at least we have some of these slides will be archived. So, Dan, I don't know. Sorry if we went just a little bit long there. I know you often go over on this, but I don't know if you want to have some questions now.
This was great. Thank you very much. And I think it is good to allow some time for questions, a lot to talk about. But in fact, let me start off with one. As I said, this is really nice work. You guys have put in a lot of effort into this. One thing that I don't see that probably has to be done at some point is to really map specific tasks to detailed requirements. That is, you know, you had a whole list of here are tasks, but you look at those tasks and the kind of telerobotic requirements that you need on your surrogate are vastly different. Even something simple like get a sample. You know, get a sample, you could say, oh yeah, let's just go out and get a random scoop somewhere and put in a bottle and send it up to orbit. You don't need any control to do that at all. You can do that autonomously. On the other hand, if you say, oh yeah, let's go out and look for, you know, reddish sharp-edged rocks that have embedded crystals and signs of layering, you say, whoa, we need some imaging resolution, we need some bandwidth, we need some power for the dexterity required to do that, and what kind of latency do we need? Those are the kinds of things that would really be helpful to map that out.
Yeah, and for what it's worth, Dan, we actually do have some of that in development. And as we're preparing this paper right now, we're talking about if and how to include some of those details. We did take a preliminary look. In fact, we have a much more detailed breakdown of tasks. And then as a function of those tasks, different kinds of work systems.
Yeah,
up
that's
the top
good.
In a spreadsheet. And we're kind of plowing through that. We did a first run through. It was kind of quick, but we did it with a team of folks. And in fact, I was just revisiting that today to figure out how we want to kind of summarize and represent this in the upcoming paper. But you're absolutely right. And in our process flow, that was a definite outcome or definite set of implications that we wanted to get to. What are the system specs ultimately?
Okay, that's really good. Yeah, you know, because the value of low latency means that you can make lots of decisions. And so you have to think about what kinds of decision making is required to do different tasks. But it's great to hear that you're working on that. Let me ask if there are other questions for these guys. Nothing else? Really?
You're going to let us go see Rick Sternbach. All right.
I'll just ask another one, and I'll say that you also, and you're probably thinking about this too, you know, you really want to consider the impact of latency. That is, it's one thing to say, okay, low latency is less than half a second, but what if the latency were 1 second, or what if it were, as for cislunar, or for Earth to Moon, a couple of seconds? What exactly is the price of latency? And like I was saying earlier, that's been mapped out in great detail for surgical telerobotics, but it hasn't been mapped out very well. Certainly, it hasn't been mapped out for doing science. And that's something that really has to be thought about.
Yeah, I think that's a big open question, science in particular, because it's so open-ended and it can be so complicated. There's so much human judgment in there. So many different potential ways of analyzing things. I think, and it's great that workshop is going to happen on it, that it is focusing on science, because I think one of the things that's in our implications that we would take away, and I've suggested this in previous meetings, is that the science is probably where the most stressing cases are for LLP, and the most complicated value proposition questions are probably buried in a lot of the science ops.
I think that's probably right. Well, let me ask again if there are other questions for these guys. They did a really nice job, and really lots to think about.
Hey, Dan, this is Jake. I just wanted to if we have another question, great. I just want to follow up on that point is, you know, most of us have probably heard the comment from Steve Squires about Murr that, you know, a human could have done what Murr did in months and, you know, a matter of days. And that's true from the perspective of covering ground physically and probably being able to pick up some samples and determine some of the information. But, you know, some of the analytical folks that I know take offense at a comment like that because there's also just an inherent delay in being able to, one, analyze, you know, quantitative geochemistry. And along with that delay is a delay in understanding what those data mean, searching for trends, understanding that information. So I think the points you just made are very important, and it's a complicated relationship between where does the lower latency get applied and how quickly does that change the way in which we can actually understand the scientific information we're collecting. And those are very complicated, very interrelated points.
Yeah, I'll just respond to that by saying, you know, one of the real issues is that we have, and I think you said this in your talk, it's very true, we have vastly more experience doing science with high latency telerobotics than low latency telerobotics. We simply don't know how to do it. And you could say, hey, you know, when you guys do field geology and you go out in the field and you're, you know, you're walking down a ravine looking at outcrops and stuff like that, you'd say, oh gosh, we'd never want to do this with high latency telerobotics. It's so nice having real time presence. Of course, it's also really nice having like a science back room. And these days, you know, these days you could have a low latency telepresence in field geology. It's really easy. You just take a grad student, give the grad student a cell phone, and you got your science back room that grad student can send pictures and talk about what they're seeing, and the science back room can think about it and tell the graduate student to do this or that. So those kinds of tests would be really interesting. You know, how well would those work?
And many of them, and many tests along those lines have been done, and a lot of stuff in the field with analogs. And Terry probably knows a bit about this. I know Jake, you've been involved in that too. The good news is, I think a lot of people are collecting data, and one very simple-minded way of thinking about this is that, and I think a lot of people have this intuition, which is why many of us are interested in trying to nail it down a little better. The common intuition is, common sense intuition is, we know we can do lots of stuff with low latency teleops on Earth. We know we can do lots of science. How different should it be in space? And it probably, in principle, shouldn't be dramatically different. But there are almost certainly some key differences that are going to be worth being prepared for. And it could come down to infrastructure. It could come down to smart systems to some extent. The expense of your assets is way more. People are much more nervous. There are way many more stakeholders. So that may raise the bar on the kinds of systems and the investments that you want to make, et cetera. But I think the good news is there's plenty of reason to think that this is well within reach and that the devil is going to be in the details.
Right. Oh, that's great.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Dan.
Okay, well, this is great. I assume there are no more questions. And you guys, again, thank you very much for putting in this time with us. And
I think we heard you all next week.
Okay.
I think we heard someone trying to get something in the background there.
Oh, I'm sorry. Was there another question?
Yeah, this is Ted Sweetser at JPL. I'll try and make it brief. One of my main motivations for being in favor of telerobotics at Mars, and this was a brilliant presentation, is that it allows you to do exploration for life, which is the real goal, without bringing contamination with you. So planetary protection is a major factor, I think, but I never heard it mentioned.
Well, yeah, we did mention it, and we talked about special regions, and that's something I'm particularly drawn to. In fact, I'm in the middle of, just before this presentation, I was working on a paper on this exact subject with someone who's worked in planetary protection for a long time, Margaret Race. I did a presentation on that at the Planetary Protection Workshop at Ames a while ago, about over a year ago. So it is potentially a huge benefit. On the other hand, you know, we don't really know yet. In fact, at Ames Workshop, that was kind of the beginning of a more formalized approach to develop requirements, or maybe not exactly requirements, but certainly guidelines. Well, I think ultimately requirements really is where they're headed. And as of right now, it looks like this is a very nice conservative posture for dealing with a lot of the contamination concerns. And it doesn't even have to be just orbit to surface. It could also be that when the crew is on the surface, there may be reasons to worry about planetary protection concerns or even contamination concerns beyond planetary protection proper. So I'm particularly partial to that, but it's a very conservative posture to take right now, but definitely worth exploring, and we're definitely interested in doing that.
Thanks. I'm glad to hear you're covering it. That's great.